Om Parthaya Pratibodhitam Bhagavatam Narayanena Swayam Vyasena Kratitam Puranamunina Madhye Mahabharatam Advaitamritavarshinim Bhagavatim Ashadashadhyayinim Ambaratvamanusandhatami Bhagavad-gītē bhavatveshinim.
Okay, we're on chapter 9, verse 32. Mahiparta dhyapashvitya Mahiparta dhyapashvitya Yepisya papayonayaha Yebisya papayonayaha Shriyo vaishyastata shudraha Shriyo vaishyastata shudraha Tepiyanti paramgatim Tepiyanti paramgatim Mam hi parta Vyapashritya Ye pi suhu Papayonayaha Striyaha Vaishaha Tata Shudraha Te Api Yanti Param Gatim. This is continuing on from the previous two verses. In the verse 30 where Bhagavan said, even if a person is a Sudracharaha, means somebody whose behavior is totally selfish and inappropriate. You know, somebody whose conduct is really bad, really, I would say, selfish and not concerned in any way about the welfare of others. So somebody who's royally screwed up, we can say, very bad. Sudracharaha. Even if there is such a person, and if that person, if such a person, you know, worships me, Pajanti Mam, Ananya Bhak, worships me not as one of the things and not for the sake of another. That's something to understand too. When you say Ananya Bhak, it means that devotion isn't divided among many things. You know, I love you and I love you and I love you and I need this and I need this and I need this and I need this. A lot of times when a person is devoted to the Lord, and prayer, for instance, is, please Lord, help me get this. And so the devotion really is toward this. And the Lord becomes a vehicle to help me get that. And there's nothing really wrong with that. At least there's some shraddha and some devotion and some recognition of a higher power other than yourself. But you're using that higher power, beseeching that higher power to give you what it is that you really want, which is some object in the world. Ananya Bhak means that the worship or what I am seeking is Ishwara himself, not Ishwara to help me get something else. That something else then is what I'm seeking. And so Ananya means other, Ananya, not another. So the Bhak, the focus, the devotion, you know, what I'm seeking is not toward something else, but is toward Mom, toward me, Krishna speaking as Ishwara. So even if somebody's a Sudracharaha, their behavior is something unacceptable in the world, they in fact should be considered as a sadhu, as somebody who is really a good person, a sadhu. Because his understanding is clear. Samyak vyavasitaha means because his understanding is clear. Why would that help? Because if a person is a mumukshu, even though they can have all kinds of problems that are causing a lot of misbehavior and hurtful behavior to others, still, nevertheless, the person is a mumukshu. And if there's a mumukshu, their understanding will and does become clear. And as it becomes clear, right, these problems that are really a pain to themselves and to everybody else will quickly drop off. That's the idea. in the light of one's knowledge, in the light of knowledge, these problems will drop off. That's in the next verse where he says, such a person will quickly, kshipram bhavati dharmatma, such a person will quickly, kshipram, become a dharmatma. They'll become somebody who follows dharma. And so all of these other kind of problems, these traumas and selfishness and self-centeredness and all of these things that cause pain to themselves and others will be replaced really by dharma. And such a person, as they gain that shanti, you know, where these bad habits are replaced by ones that are more in line with Ishvara, and more in line with yourself also. It's also not to think that a person, a mamukshu, who is dealing with a lot of baggage or a lot of reactivity to the way that they react to the world in a way that is painful to others. What is painful to others is for the most part painful to yourself also, you know. And it's going against the dharma of Ishvara. And so you yourself will find yourself pulling back as you assimilate your experience. And if you are mumukshu and gaining clarity of knowledge, you are assimilating your experience. And that means this misbehavior or painful behavior is something that is not resonating with you either. Nor is it resonating with Ishvara, nor is it resonating with the natural order of things. You say it's not resonating. Why do you say it's not resonating with the natural order of things? It's because you're getting a symptom. You're getting a symptom. The symptom is dukkha. The symptom is pain. So when you get pain, that's just Bhagavan's way of saying, you know, let's pull away from this. Let's pull away from this behavior, you know. Just like we always use the example of when you're going through life and say you have never seen fire before and you just stick your hand in it and you get burnt. You stick your hand in it, you get burnt. What does that tell you? It tells you not to stick your hand in there again. You know? What does it tell you when you're cruel to another person and you see you see their reaction, but you don't only just see their reaction, you feel the pain of your own reaction. What does that tell you? Adjustment. And adjustment necessary. You know, it's like a red flag. Adjustment is necessary. And we continually learn like this. Everybody at the whole universe, people will say, you know, we learn from our suffering, or the whole universe and every moment in our life is really guiding us toward dharma. What is the teacher? It's pain, you know, discomfort. And so as we assimilate our experience, we move more and more and more toward that natural order of things, because the unnatural order will push us back. So here he says, a person who is somebody who has a clarity of understanding, even if their conduct is something that we don't agree with or that we find hurtful or rough or mean, nevertheless, because their clarity of understanding is there, they should be considered as a sadhu, as a good person. And their behavior, their mind, will quickly, kshipram, go toward dharma. And having gone toward dharma, they will gain a shanti, the shanti which is shashwat, means anitya, it means nitya, means a shanti of peace that is the very nature of the self. That shanti that doesn't come and go. It's the same as self-knowledge. So he says, hey, Kaunteya, please understand pratijanihi. Understand without any doubt, without any vagueness or exception, that my bhakta is not destroyed. My bhakta will never be destroyed. Please understand that. Please have that shraddha. It's like saying, I will stick with you all of the way. I won't abandon you. I'll stick with you all of the way. I'll make sure that all of these things are taken care of over time and that you gain your knowledge. I'll stick with you. So that's really... Then he says, he goes on to say in this next verse, so he says, hey Partha, I'll just do... Some people want this verse, these words done in order, so I'll do them in order and then I'll make it more clear. Mom means me. He... Because mom, me, referring to Ishvara. So mom, me, referring to Ishvara. Pikahi, because. Hey, Partha. Partha is the son of Prithu. It's a name for Arjuna. Vyapashritya means, in the Kalimbo past participle, it means, you know, having sought me with devotion, having served me, having sought me, having become a mumukshu whose focus is on me, who's seeking me. So having sought me, been devoted to me. Yea, those who upi, even suhu, are papa yoniyaha, papa yonis means a person born in the womb. Yoni is a womb of a papi, means of people who are one way of saying that go against dharma. You've taken a birth amidst people who really go against the dharma, people who are not the best adharmic people. So first line it says, hey Partha, even those people, you know, who are born in an adharmic family, in a bad family, having been devoted to me, it's the first line. So hey Partha, because even those people who are poppies, born in a bad family, those people being devoted to me, and then he says, and similarly tata striyaha, women, vaishaha, vaishyas, business people, shudras, and shudras. I'll explain why he says all these three in a minute. Even those people also, they yanti, they go to this param gati, that gati, which is param supreme, which is myself. The param gati means Brahman. To that gati, that abode which is infinite. So it's param gati is a name for Brahman. So here, so he says, he's saying now, the person of improper, in the previous verse, people of improper contact, they become dharmis and they gain me. Why? Because they're mumukshus and they're seeking me. He says, even papayonis, people who are born in really bad families who seek me, they also attain me. And also women. Women aren't really women. Vaishyas in the caste system, the Vaishyas and the Shudras are not really part of a lot of the rituals and things that are within the Vedic culture. You know, the Vaishyas, the businessmen, and the Shudras aren't included in that. And women aren't also included in many ways. And so women are looked at also as people often who are very emotional and they're interested in raising their taking care of their children and raising their family. And so they're not really given the same respect in terms of the Vedic culture in certain ways that the men are. They're given tremendous respect actually as the people, as the ones who take care of the home and take care of the family and hold the dharma and pass the dharma, and that way they are. But in terms of being active in the maintaining of the Vedic culture, not so much. And the Vaishyas are business people. They're not really maintaining the Vedas. You know? Whereas the Kshatriyas and the Brahmanas, they do maintain the whole Vedic culture. The Vaishyas are within the Vedic culture, but they're not so active in maintaining it. And the Shudras are just the common people who are laborers and people who are working. They also are not really expected to be maintaining, you know, the Vedic culture, passing on the knowledge and all of this thing. So they are looked down upon. But here, even in the Brahma Sutras that Shankara is commentating on, the first sutra says, Atato Brahma Jignasa. Now therefore, the desire to know Brahman. It's a Brahma Sutra, the first Brahma Sutra. How that is interpreted is as soon as a person gains that adhikarityam, means the viveka, the vairagya, the shamadhamma paratitiksha, all of these qualifications that are necessary for a person to become a mumukshu, a seeker. You can say just very simply, once a person becomes a seeker, whether they're sudura-achara, whether they themselves are really, really mean and selfish, or whether they're born in a family of criminals, you know, or really bad people, or whether they be a woman or a businessman or a laborer, you know, it doesn't make any difference at all. If that mumukshutvam is there, if they seek me as Ananyabhak, they seek me, means they say they want to gain knowledge of me. They don't seek me so that I will give them something else. They seek me. If they seek me, no matter who they are, what their family is, where they come from, they will gain me. That's the promise of the Shruti. Swamiji talks about this in so many ways. It's so important to understand that. That in fact, they go so far as to say that if a person is a mumukshu, means that they desire this knowledge. They are ready for this knowledge, that mumukshutvam is there. Mumukshutvam means desire for liberation. Whenever that mumukshutvam is there, then that person will be united to with their teacher. Either they'll find themselves being flown halfway across the world to meet their teacher, or their teacher will fly all the way across the world to meet them. You know, unbeknownst to anybody, it will take place once a person is a mumukshu. And this is just another way of Bhagavan's promise. If that mumukshutvam is there, if this you are ready for this knowledge and it is what you are seeking, then definitely you will get it. My devotee will never be left out, will never come to harm. That's the idea. And so he says this now, bringing in all of these various types of people so that he can say in this next verse, so he says, kim punar brahmanah punyaha, kim punar brahmanah punyaha, bhaktara jarshayastata, bhaktara jarshayastata, anityamasukam lokam, anityamasukam lokam, imam prapya bhajasvamam, imam prapya bhajasvamam. Kim punar brahmanaha punyaha bhaktaha rajarshayaha tatha anityam asukam lokam imam prapya bhajasva mam. So he says that kim punar is like what to speak of, or what to speak of a Brahman, the Brahmanas. In the Kshatriya, in the caste system, the Brahmanas are the priestly class, the educated class, the ones who are totally involved in and engaged in the study of the Vedas. So, and the Brahmanas are considered to have the most sattva, means their mind is the mind of a scholar, of somebody who's a contemplative person. That's a Brahmana. So what to speak of the contemplative, the contemplative person, people who are totally engaged in the study of Vedas. By their very caste, that's what they do. They're just totally engaged in the study of the Vedas. So what to speak about the Brahmanas who are punyaha? They themselves have a very privileged birth in that they're born into a Dharmic family, into a Vedic family. So privileged. And being born into a privileged family means it's an punya, means it's a lot of punya, a lot of good karma got them there. That's the punya. So they're born into a family because of tremendous punya. They themselves are bhaktas. So it says, what to speak of some people who are brahmanas, who are born into a dharmic, into a punya, they have a birth based upon punya, good karma, and who are bhaktaha, devotees. And similarly, the rajarshiyaha, the kshatriyas. The kshatriyas are the kingly class and the warrior. So Brahmana and Kshatriya are considered the highest classes, in the highest class in terms of their involvement in the Vedas and their learning. So, and similarly, the Raja Rishis, that's another name for Swamiji, just like Kshatriyas. Raja Rishis are rishis who are kings. But they're...
Who's the highest class?
Brahmana. The Brahmanas, the priestly class. Highest means most valued. Mm-hmm. The Brahmana class. Then the Kshatriya, then the Vaishya, and then the Shudra. So he says, what to speak of the Brahmanas those people who are brahmanas, who have this birth that requires tremendous punya, and who themselves are bhaktas, and the kshatriyas also who are like that, who are born into a very good family and who have a lot of devotion and bhakti to Ishwara. He says, what to speak of those people? Then he says, anityam asukam lokam imam prapya. They, having attained lokam imam, this world, they're born into this world. It's tremendous punya to take a human birth in this world. And you take a human birth, and the birth you have is one where there is a lot of privilege, there's a lot of opportunity given to you in terms of dharma. Not in terms of wealth and all this, in terms of dharma, in terms of values. So you have a lot of privilege in that way, you have a lot of support. So having taken birth in this world, which is anitya, anitya means everything in it is changing, and it is asukha. Every sukha you have goes away. That's what they mean by asukha. It's not just that everything in the world is dukkha, is sorrowful. It's asukha. It means every pleasure that you have goes away. It's anitya. So they say asukha means there's not much sukha in it. There's not much pleasure in it because every pleasure goes away. Everything is anitya. Anitya means time-bound. So here are these brahmanas, these privileged people in terms of dharma. They're born into this world that's anitya. Everything is coming and going. And every sukha, every pleasure goes away. So such people, bhajaswa mam, may they seek me. One of the great things, one of the great blessings, in fact, in taking this human birth, is that everything is anitya. Everything is time-bound in this creation, without exception. Everything is time-bound. You have a buddhi, you have an intellect, you know, that can assimilate your experience. You can experience over and over and over again. Remember, we've had beginningless births. Over and over again, that every moment of sukha you have is just that. It's a moment. And that every wonderful experience you have will have something coming in to take it away. From some angle, either the beautiful experience, you yourself will get bored with it. That's one way it gets taken away. Another person will come in and be an obstruction to it. Or the universe itself will just go on moving and the situation passes. There isn't an exception to that. You try to give one. Try to find an exception to it. The only thing that there is only one exception to it, and that is your own swabhava, your own nature. That's the exception. Because that's the only thing there is that is not subject to change. And the nature of your own swabhava is ananda, is fullness, is completeness. That one is the one who is invariably present to the flow of experience. That's the one that needs to be recognized. And actually the flow of experience, as we did in the meditation, the flow of experience that you have, which is full of sukha-dukkha, 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 or just all of the neutral experiences also, that entire flow of experience on every level has for its constant being pervasive to the entire experience, as it's the constant being, which is you. And the nature of you needs to be differentiated from this flow of experience. The nature of you is the ananda, or the fullness that in fact you're seeking to find in the experience. That's why this viveka, this discrimination, has to take place, so that you can see, as the very abiding self of every single experience you have, you know, is your changeless being. And what is the nature of that changeless being? Is it positive or negative? Say, it is the most positive. It is the one of the totality of experience. You know, it's all right that all of these experiences come and go. That's all right. Even the ones I like, they all come and go. I can live with it. Just don't let me go. Right? Let me remain. Let these negative experiences go. Let the world go on changing, everything coming and going, but I'm not ready to go. So, who's that one? Don't let me go. That's a tremendous commitment. It's a tremendous protection. You're very protective about your own being. Now, in terms of the world, you are very protective, in a sense, we could say, about your happy experiences, ananda, but you're not protective about your unhappy experiences. It's obvious, right? You're not protective about your unhappy experiences. You know? In the sense that it's all right for those to go. It's all.
Some of us hold on to that for a long time.
That's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah.
But if we analyze it, there's reasons for that. And the reasons are your own seeking of happiness. The ananda, but there nobody gets more priya, what we call more love, than your own presence. Otherwise, Swamiji will joke sometimes about getting moksha, because in India some people will think that once you gain liberation, you know, you lose your body and you lose everything. You lose what you think is yourself. You gain moksha, you'll lose your personal self and all of this. They have all kinds of notions, not true at all, but it's just the notions that you bring when you come to teaching. And so then, you know, Swamiji will say, like, if that was true, you know, that if it is true that when you're liberated, you're going to lose yourself, then would anybody want to be liberated? Or would you say, I do want to be liberated, but not today. I want to be liberated, but tomorrow, not right now. I know that liberation is good and all that, but not right now. It's the same thing. People say, it's another thing you'll talk about. People will say, I'm not afraid of death. Right? I'm not afraid of death. No, not at all. All right then. No, not right now. I'm not afraid of death. It's fine. It's fine with me. I accept it, really. Okay.
Next year.
Or tomorrow. Or tomorrow, or tomorrow, tomorrow. Not right now. No. That's interesting. So, you don't want to die. What is your nature? What is your nature? Is it sukha or dukkha? So, you know, you should ask, and it's because it's not the same type, it's not the sukha and dukkha that comes and goes, like you have a happy experience and a happier experience and even a happier experience that comes, the different pleasures that come and go. It's not that kind of sukha. So what kind of sukha is it? Well, it's not a sukha that comes and goes.
It's ananda.
It's ananda. But we can call, people call this ananda, this coming and going. They identify ananda with sukha. But we say, this isn't a coming, the experience of coming and going, variegated pleasure. It's just the indescribable wholeness and nature of your own being. We call it ananda. And so then we say, well, what is that like? Well, we can say almost in like an analogy, it's like the sukha that you experience in the world. You know how the sukha, the happiness you experience in the world, how that pleases you, it's something that you love to have, that took pleasurable experiences, and the dark experiences are ones that you want to get rid of. Yourself resonates with those sukha experiences. But to really understand what we mean by ananda, you can only understand that by recognizing your own nature. And so one way to do that, to say, like, it's a good, it's a really beautiful meditation. It's just, you're sitting in meditation and you're starting to really relax and focusing just on your nature, just the nature of the silent being that you are, just your own presence. All of this stuff, thoughts are coming and going, and maybe feelings are wafting through, and perceptions are wafting through. But your own presence, you slow things down, and you become just aware of just your abiding presence, that self-shining me. And then let the mind ask, what am I like? What is my own presence like? Is it happy? Is it sad? Why do they call me, my presence, ananda? Why have they labeled it that, ananda? Then you have to say, What's ananda about me? Why is it? Why is that word chosen? And then you have to relate the word ananda with the content that that word is pointing to. And you can use experiences like pleasure in the world and love, compassion, different positive emotions we have as pointers that have some similarity to the nature of your own self, which is called ananda. These positive experiences we have are pointers to yourself that is ananda and present to even the negative spectrum. See, that's the thing. In the world, we have a negative spectrum that's called dukkha, sorrowful spectrum of experiences, and sukha, the positive spectrum, pleasure of experiences. Ananda, my own wholeness and fullness, is independent and present to all of those. Not that we're going to embrace the negative. We will embrace the negative with love to make it go away. Right? The negative experiences, we know how to hold them so that they'll relax. Mm. And the negative experience that is being produced will dissipate. You know, in the positive experiences, you'll find the mind already is deeply relaxed. It's kind of like a clear water bucket reflecting the sun. Mm. And so those positive experiences, the clear water bucket, you know, is that has a reflection of the sun in it, is more resonant with the sun than like a muddy water bucket, you know, that's not reflecting the sun, even though the sun is illumining both. So like that for my mind, when my mind has stillness and peace, it resonates very deeply with myself, right? And when my mind is agitated, it doesn't resonate with my own nature, and so it feels very bad. I want to get rid of it. Nevertheless, just like the sun is equally present without prejudice to the muddy water bucket and to the clear water bucket, like that, my being is exactly the same, without any change whatsoever, same abiding presence to the negative vrittis, negative thoughts, and positive thoughts. I like the positive thoughts because they're so resonant with my nature. The negative thoughts are like a foreign entity has come in and I want to get rid of them. Yeah. But actually for a jnani, for somebody who has self-knowledge, I am shining there as my being is shining there equally in all of those thoughts. And so here, when you take this birth and you're a mumukshu, this creation by its nature will create mumukshutvam in you, because everything in this creation is anitya, means everything is time bound. And every sukha, every pleasure that you have goes away. And so that means that every pleasure that you have goes away, you're put into a state of loss or a state of pain, which doesn't resonate with you. And so you're going around trying to find yourself in this world that can only give you momentary, analogous glimpses of your own nature. You know, they're not exactly the same, they're analogous. You know, it's like the sun in the mirror is not quite the same as the sun. Right? You see that? The sun in the mirror is not the same as the sun. There's a difference, but they're analogous. And so here, the sukha experiences that I have in the mind, they're not the same as me, but they're analogous. And so they're comfortable. Mm. Right? Well, you're seeking yourself in analogous experiences that by their nature come and go. Right? And so what we have to do is, and that will make a mumukshu out of you. and so that's what he's saying here. With all privilege, even talking to Arjuna, who is a kshatriya, has been born in tremendous privilege. His brother Yudhishthira was a Raja Rishi, who was the king of Dharma. He was a Dharmanishta, you know. And so they couldn't be more privileged in terms of their values and their knowledge, you know. And here Arjuna is experiencing calamity,
everything being wiped out, tremendous loss, all of the things that they valued, all of the relationships they had, all of the things that they owned, all of the things that gave them happiness, totally decimated, you know, with and looking into the future, just seeing more decimation. So he was in kind of a perfect situation for somebody who was on borderline, in a way, to become a mumukshu. And that's when his whole relationship to Krishna changed. He said, please teach me, you know, please accept me as your student. Until then, he had just a respectful relationship with Krishna. And Krishna was a good friend and somebody he deeply respected. And then all of a sudden he realized, what am I doing just hanging out with Bhagavan without asking him, you know, what is the reality of all of this? Yeah. That was his, you know, here I've just been being with him and enjoying him, you know, as my friend, you know, when he viewed him really as the Lord. What am I doing? If there's anybody to ask, what is the reality? Why not ask him? And so then he did, please accept me as your sishya, please teach me, you know, and then Krishna did. We're halfway through now. So he taught him. So when he's saying this, what to speak of the brahmanas and kshatriyas that are in such a privileged position like yourself, you know, look at this world. You've taken birth here, look at this world. The whole thing is anitya. It's continually changing, it's time bound, every experience you have. It's not sukha, it's asukha. Every sukha you have becomes asukha. It goes away. Every sukha goes away. You can't say it's sukha because as soon as it's there, it'll disappear. You know? So, seeing that, then, seek me. Seek me. Seek me means serve me, worship me, seek me. This word, budge again. It means seeking me, the only way you can seek me, because what we seek in the world are just objects. Seeking me means to know me. Be a mumukshu, seek me, gain knowledge of me, know who I am. Mm.
Okay. That word is means budge. Fullness.
Budge.
Bush.
Budge. Bush. No, is budge not. Is budgeswa. Budgeswa is a verb.
Oh.
And it means to seek,
oh,
to worship, you know, to seek in terms of knowledge, to serve, seek, serve. Okay. It has a lot of different meanings. But here it's in terms of mumukshutva. And so here in this last verse, so he says, so seek me. And then he says what he means by that. He says, manmana pavamad bhaktaha, manmana pavamad bhaktaha, madhyaji mam namaskuru, madhyaji mam namaskuru, mamai vaishasya yuktvai. Yutvaivam, mame vaishyasi yutvaivam, atmanam matparayanaha, atmanam matparayanaha, manmanaha bhava, madbhaktaha, madhyaji, mam namaskuru, mam eva eshyasi, yuktva, evam atmanam matparayanaha. So what does it mean to seek me or to be focused on me? He says, manmanaha, your mind should be focused on me. Manas is the mind. So let the mind be focused on me. Man means mad, me. Manmanaha. Bhava means be. May you be one whose mind is focused on me. Mad bhaktaha. May you be devoted to me. Means not to something else. May your love be for me. Mad bhaktaha. Madhyaji. May the rituals you do be done for me, not for an object. In other words, this is something important in the Vedic culture where they have so many different rituals that are enjoined that they have to do. Those rituals can be done with a sankalpa in order to gain something in the world, to go to Swargaloka, to have a child, or whatever. Let the rituals be done for my sake, means for karma yoga, for antakarna shuddhi, for purity of mind. So that's the karma yoga, madhyaji. Mam namaskuru, may you be surrendered to me. It means may I come first, may dharma come first. Mam eva eshasi, yuktva evam atmanam matparayanaha. He says, matparayanaha, for someone of the, like this, for whom I am matparayanaha, I am the highest abode, means I am what you are seeking, matparayanaha. Then, yuktva evam atmanam, having made your mind in this manner, having become like this, where all of you is focused on me in every way, what you are seeking is only me, then having done that, mam eva eshasi, then you will be me. Having become a matparayanaha, where I am what is primary for you, I am what is primary, nothing else, you know, then you will gain me. And actually, so now there's a second way. If this is the way Swamiji likes it, is taking it like this, there's another way of taking it where you say, having become matparayanaha, somebody who is in all of these ways totally focused on me, I am what is important to you, to the Lord, not some object or not something. I am what it is that you seek, what you want to know. Then you can take it like this. Then you will attain me, who is Atman, who is the self of all beings. Atman, then, instead of being, meaning the mind, which having made your mind like this, that's one way of taking it. The other way is just having gained some shanti, just taking yuktva evam, having gained clarity of mind, you being a matparayanaha, you will obtain me, who is the Atma, who is the self in all beings. Shankara takes it that way. This other way, Swamiji likes the other way a little bit better, so other commentators take it the other way, where instead of taking the self as the self of all beings, take the self as the mind, because then you would say, having developed in this way, in this manner that we've been, because it says Avam, in this manner that we've just gone through, then having done that, you will come to me. I shall see us in the future. You will come to me. Being somebody whose mind is totally turned toward me. There's no exception. You know, it's not like, well, I want you, but I want this too. To the degree that you want this, there's dukkha. That's why this I want this too becomes a sadhana. You know, you either want knowledge to know that I am the whole, or you want this. As soon as you want this, you're in samsara. Mm-hmm. But all of us start wanting this and this and this, you know. But in the end, you want what you want, this, this, and this, as the prarabdha, as the karmas of your life unfold. But it's a different type of wanting. It's what we call a dugdha bija, a burnt seed wanting, where I want this, but if I don't get it, that's fine. Oh yeah, I want this, let me go there. If it doesn't work out, that's fine. That's freedom. It's not as though a mumukshu or a jnani, all of a sudden in their mind, there's the word want doesn't exist anymore. You know what I mean? That it isn't there. If it's not there, you can't move. Like say, oh, I'm thirsty, I want a drink of water. Instead it would just be, I'm thirsty.
As opposed to what?
Getting up and getting a drink of water. You know? I want. Want is energy. It's the energy. Icha. Icha is the energy. You go toward things. But is your ananda dependent? I must have this in order to be happy. You see what I mean? That's the problem. That's when I would pray to Bhagawan, please let me have this so that I can be happy. That means there's no viveka there. Because that thing's not going to make you happy. That'll give you a little spurt of happiness. So there's a whole shift in the way that you see the world and you see yourself and you see Ananda. You'll see as you're maturing and growing, you would rather, you know, be able to enjoy your experience as it is, so that you can have shanti, so that you can have that peace, rather than getting so engaged in the experience that it has to be this way or that way or this or there or that way, so that I can be happy. More and more it becomes not worth it. Because your ananda has really nothing to do, you know, with this being this way or this being that way. It has to do with your attitude toward this being this way or this being that way. In the end, that's what it is, because your ananda, the ananda that you're seeking, has nothing to do with the world, really. It's the self of the ananda that you're seeking is the self of the world. Just like the graham crackers. A child needs the horse graham cracker instead of the cow graham cracker. You know, the jnani, the mother, says, a graham cracker is a graham cracker. You know what I mean? So it's fine. Whether I'm looking this way, it's the Atma. Whether I'm looking this way, it's the Atma. This way, the Atma. This experience is the Atma. This experience is the Atma. This thought is the Atma. This thought is the Atma. Why do I need the Atma in this form as opposed into this form? It depends on what you're focusing on, you know. And if you're focusing on the form, then there's delusion there. There's delusion. And it never works. It never works. You'll get a moment of happiness only to have it squeezed out. Squeezed out, dripped off, disappear. And that's our continual experience. And so that's why Bhagavan's saying there's no exceptions. It doesn't work. Either you recognize yourself as the whole, and if there's the whole, you're the whole, there's nothing else. You see what I mean? If you are the whole, then there's nothing that is not you. And so there's nothing to want. I don't need this in order to be happy because I already am the whole. I'm already the graham cracker. You see what I mean? I already am that. And so that's why he's saying in all ways that has to be understood. To the degree that it's not understood, there's samsara there. And that becomes your sadhana. That's where you bring in your knowledge. And in the end, what you're left with, that's why he says, the matparayanaha, the one for whom I am the one who is sought, for that person, they attain me. Why? Because I'm the self of all beings. There's nothing here but me. And so they attain me through knowledge is what it is. But there's no exception to it. You know? That's why when you're reading it, it sounds like, isn't that a bit extreme? You know?
Fanatic.
Isn't it extreme? You know, give me a break. You have to think about me. You have to be devoted to me. All the rituals that you do have to be for my sake. You have to surrender to me. You know, I have to be what is total for you. Matparayanaha. There should be nothing else. I should be the final abode for you. You know?
It's kind of a lot like when Christ said, I am the truth, the way, and the light. It brings that to mind.
It does. But see, what people don't understand, and they can misunderstand this too, if it's Krishna talking, say, Krishna as a form, as a human being, even as an avatar within the creation, you know, then that's a problem. You know, because then within one part is worshipping another part. But here and throughout the Gita, Krishna is speaking, when he's speaking as Ishvara, it's I am the whole, I am the self in all beings. You know, and so that's what you need to be seeking. Then you will attain me, the one who is the self of all beings. That's why Shankara takes it that way. You will gain me. You will come to me. Who is the Atma? Come to me, who is the Atma? The one who is the truth, the self of all of this. Yeah? But you can't come to me, the one who is the self of all of this, if you're seeking an object, a form.
Right.
It won't happen. And so your whole mind has to mature into that, just to mature into that knowledge. You have to gain, I put it, that's maybe backwards way to put it. You have to gain this knowledge and your emotional, the manas, the mind matures into that understanding.
Mm-hmm.
Right? You gain the knowledge, you know, and you gain nishtha, you gain strength in that knowledge, and then the mind tags along. It's what we call an emotional lag time. You know, because you know something, but that knowledge has to penetrate through all of the different layers of your psyche, including all of the little ones inside that are saying, yeah, but what if don't leave me? What about me? Which is true. Those ones all have to, all the different parts have to be integrated and brought along. That's what takes some love and some patience, you know, to let all of those, the different parts in us, I mean, there's all different ages going on inside, all different levels of maturity, psychological and spiritual maturity, you know. So many different levels, and they're all slowly, you know, assimilating, growing up and healing and assimilating knowledge. It takes a lot of love, a lot of patience, you know, to let all of that happen. And that's why they have so much in the Gita, so much karma yoga and all of that. You know. Okay, let's do this final little prayer. I'll get it from this book. Om Tatsata, Om Tatsata, Iti Srimad Bhagavad Gita Su Upanishatsu, Iti Srimad Bhagavad Gita Su Upanishatsu, Brahma Vidyayam Yoga Shastre, Brahma Vidyayam Yoga Shastre, Shri Krishna Arjuna Samvade, Shri Krishna Arjuna Samvade, Rajavidya Rajaguhya Yogo, Rajavidya Rajaguhya Yogo, Nama Navamodhyayaha, Nama Navamodhyayaha. So it says Om Tat Sat, Om, Om Tat, that is the truth, Sat, Om, that is the truth, Om is the truth, Om, that is the truth. Iti thus, Srimad Bhagavad Gita Su, in the Srimad Bhagavad Gita Upanishad Su, which is an Upanishad, means it's likened to an Upanishad, even though it's not an Upanishad within the tradition, because it's being taught by Krishna, Lord Krishna, and it's totally in line with the vision of the Upanishad. It itself is honored by being considered as an Upanishad. So in the Bhagavad Gita, in the Srimad Bhagavad Gita, which is and considered an Upanishad, honored as an Upanishad, which is Brahma Vidya, which is the knowledge which contains the, which is the Brahma Vidya, the teaching of Brahma Vidya, the knowledge of Brahman, and which is a Yoga Shastra. The Yoga Shastra means it is a Shastra which teaches all the Karma Yoga for Antakarana Shuddhi, everything that you need for gaining the qualifications, the mental, emotional qualifications that are necessary to abide in this knowledge. It's a Yoga Shastra, Shastra for Karma Yoga. Sri Krishna Arjuna Samvade, in this dialogue between Krishna and Arjuna, Samvada means teacher-student dialogue. It's not just you and I talking, it's a teacher-student, not friendship, a teacher-student dialogue. So Krishna Arjuna, and or Sri Krishna Arjuna Samvade in this dialogue. Raja Vidya, this king of knowledge, Raja means in this king of knowledges, which is Raja Guhya, the greatest secret, right? Because the self, you know, the seeker is hidden in the sought. You can even say the seeker is the sought. The seeker is the sought, but it's hidden in the sought. It's not known, so there's no greater secret. You know, you're looking everywhere, and yet what you're looking for is, you know, the one who's looking. Then what you're really looking for is the nature of the one who's looking. So there could be no greater secret. What's called the greatest secret, Rajaguhya, Yoga. Yoga means subject matter. Who's subject in this context? whose subject matter is this king of knowledges, the Upanishad knowledge of the Brahman, which is the greatest secret. So that's its name. So Navama Adhyayaha, this ninth chapter, which is, whose subject matter is this king of not this king of knowledges, the Brahma Vidya, which is the greatest secret. So which is called this Raja Vidya, Raja Yoga, Yoga. That's its the name of the chapter. So this is the ninth chapter in this dialogue between Lord Krishna and Arjuna, you know, which is itself a yoga shastra, and which is the knowledge of Brahma Vidya, you know, found in this Bhagavad Gita, which is honored as an Upanishad.
Which so is what?
Honored as considered an Upanishad, likened to an Upanishad. So this always is chanted at the end, right? Just kind of telling the name of the chapter and everything. Okay. So. Let's take a minute. Om Purnamada Purnamidam Purnat Purnamadachate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vashishyate Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Hari Om. It's nice we finished because next Thursday is Thanksgiving.
Oh, yeah.
So we'll have class next Thursday.
So, start chapter 10 on...
The week after.
Okay, good.
The week after Thanksgiving.
So this is a detail, but here's Sat is true.
Yeah. Sat has different meanings. It comes from the root us, to be. And so sat is actually a present participle, means being.
Exactly.
Yeah. And then being is all sometimes translated as the good, like a sat purusha means a good person. Mm. So it has that meaning. It also has satyam, means that which is true.
Right. Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So tat sat, that which is, in the sense, that which is the truth. But the truth is sat. See, sat is that which can't be negated in past, present, or future. So such a thing actually is. Anything else that is bordered by asat, non-existence, can't have existence in the middle, so it doesn't have any real being. Right? Anything that comes into being and goes out of being has non-existence on either side, so it's not really true. So what is... what actually is in reality, that is true. So you see how we go from being to true? Mm-hmm. Well, you wouldn't say that something that has no being is true.
Right, no.
Right. So what is being is true. But it's not true if it only has temporary being. Then we call it mitya, because it's dependent on something which is for it to be, and that which is true. Like if you have the clay pot, the clay is true. The pot doesn't have any being apart from the clay, so the pot is mitya. Right, so if I made the pot into a plate, the pot is no more. The clay still is. The clay is real, not the form, because the form is really, in truth, only clay. So a clay pot is a great example. We just wring it dry. We use it for so many things, but it's... something so profound to be understood just in using the clay pot. That relationship between pot and clay. It's Satyamitya.
The term sadhu?
Sadhu. That's different. That's different etymology. Different than sat.
Is it true that someone that has this knowledge, this understanding, a good clarity, would you say it's true for everyone that has that, that this process of maturing takes place and that this unwinding is goes on through one's whole life kind of thing? Is that the right way to look at it?
It's unavoidable.
What?
It's unavoidable. So you can't stop it.
So even, say, for very cultured teachers, say, that process is going on as well. It's not just for the aspiring students or the ones that are trying to...
There's an endless, infinite subtleties of understanding, though, and learning within duality. Mm-hmm. There's not an increase in recognizing your own self. Mm-hmm. But in terms of learning that kaushalam, you know, learning how to be in the world, mm-hmm. how to relate with people, how to grow, how to handle your own mind, all of these, it's nuanced. But there does come a time when the vairagya, or that kind of... not asking things to be different, becomes such that the mind doesn't trouble you anymore. But that doesn't mean that you don't continue to learn, you know. Because even a mind that has some agitation doesn't trouble you. It's kind of like they use the example of like...
You mean even your own mind being agitated doesn't trouble you?
Oh. Right. Because there's nobody hanging on to it and saying, oh, my mind shouldn't be like this, or if my mind's like this, I can't be happy. So they use the example of writing on water. You know, if you write on water, the writing is there, but it disappears as you write, you know. It's not that it's not happening, but it's also not leaving much of a trail. Another example they use is like a bird, you know, flying through space. It doesn't leave a trail. And so the sukhas and dukkhas and emotions and things that are happening, there's no one inside building up on it or making it an issue. And so when it's not being made an issue, you know, and not engaging in it as though it should lead to something, you know, that's the vairagya, in a sense. You're not building up on it. Then it's like riding on water, because there's no one creating a network around it. So, and so then that understanding increases, and you gain anishta in that understanding before all of the nuanced understanding in the world stops there from being any agitation. But the agitation doesn't bother you. Then there's a time before that, the agitation bothers you. You know, so I'm just saying there's no end to learning and no end to growth and no end to connections.
Swamiji's commentary where he says, even if you have a sad mind, 1 + 1 is still 2.
Yeah.
You know, I love that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's just recently.
What was it again?
If you have a sad mind, 1 + 1 is still 2. In other words,
mind.
What he's talking about?
The state of your mind is not.
Doesn't harm your knowledge.
Knowledge is solid. You get it.
Yeah.
I got it.
That's really beautiful. He just recently said that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That he was talking about how emotions and experiences don't change what you know. But here, one thing to understand too, to make that even more, to me, I think more profound, even is that if you say 1 + 1 = 2, that's a theoretical knowledge. Here, the knowledge is your own being. The knowledge of your own being also doesn't go away. I think he's talking more, a little bit more theoretically, but this is also true. Your own presence doesn't go away, no matter what is going on in the mind, because it's a fact. You
but
are
sometimes
there.
Knowing that doesn't give relief to what's going on in the mind. I mean,
well, I'm saying that's true, but that's because that there's no vairagya in that area. There's no dispassion in that area. Mm. The thing that's creating the pain is because mm-hmm. you need it to be different in order for you to be happy. Or you have fear, like, if this doesn't happen, I'm not going to be happy. Mm. You know, and so those are the areas where we, those are our sadhanas. Each one of those areas is a sadhana. It's something for me to be with. That's my work. Right? Because in that area, I'm getting taken away on a trip. Mm. Which is fine. I mean, that's all part of it, isn't it? You know? Otherwise, you come to knowledge kind of like Ramana, where all of that work has been done. And the teacher just lights the match and throws it on the gasoline. You know, and poof, it's all over. But for most of us, I mean, we are coming with certainly what we call adhikaritvam, enough, we have enough qualifications to be a mumukshu, and there's still growth that has to happen. You know, like some people, the level of vairagya, for instance, that you come to this teaching with varies. But for everybody, it's going to be enough to bring you to this teaching. Whereas for someone who's been assimilating their experience in certain ways for a longer time in reference to this life, you know, that maturing in terms of vairagya may be, you know, they might be pretty well on their way, where another person has more work to do around that.
Well, does that depend on your ability or your capacity, or does that come by itself?
It's not ability and capacity. It's the assimilation of experience. Mm-hmm. And it takes a long time, but here's how to think about it, you know, in case you are into comparing yourself with others.
Sure.
<Who is it? laughs>
You think, when did we start? Beginningless. So how many lives have you had?
Beginningless.
A lot of them. Okay, beginningless. So already, you know, don't be too proud of yourself. It's beginningless, right? But the thing is, for everybody at any point, beginningless. Beginningless. Okay. So now, say, this particular life, because I hear this from people, you know, someone comes to this knowledge when they're 20, you know, and somebody comes when they're 60, and the 60-year-old will say, oh my gosh, if only I could have come to this knowledge when I was 20, right? I would be so much better off. Instead, I'm coming to this knowledge when I'm 60. Or 70, you know? That just doesn't seem right. What was I doing all those years? Okay, so that's looking at ourselves as just in this life, right?
Yeah.
But remember, you had a prior life. So you had a prior life. And in that prior life, when you were 60, you were the one saying, why did I wait so long? But now you meet up with your teacher in this life when you're 20.
Earlier.
But the 60-year-old is saying, you know, the 60-year-old now is looking back at you and saying, aren't you great? You know? But that 60-year-old will meet up, but they don't finish the job now. It means that vairagya isn't there and they still have a lot of things to work out and they want to take another life and all of this. Then they meet up there with their teacher when they're young, and then all of the others are like, oh, wow. You know? But all along, you've all had beginningless lives. So it's really kind of interesting. Say if you go back, you know, a million years. Say we go back a million years. All of those people have had beginningless lives. However, they got knowledge a million years before you did. It's ridiculous. It's Maya. That's Maya. You know. We're assimilating what I'm saying is that you're assimilating your experience over lifetimes until you become a mumukshu. That's what it is. Over lifetimes, you assimilate your experience until finally, at some point, you've assimilated your experience to the degree that you become a mumukshu. So here you have how many lifetimes, who knows how many lifetimes it's taken for a person to ask that question, like, who am I? And is there anything in this world that doesn't change? Is there any way that I can just be happy without having, or whole, without having to always be maintaining it? You gain that question. So at some time, you've assimilated your experience, at some point it dawns on you. Now that point, over lifetimes, may be when you're 15, in this birth. Or it may have been when you were 80, in your last birth. Or 60 in this birth. Or 30 in the next birth. It just depends on how long, you know, it's taken for all of the pieces to come together. And it's considered an incredible punya for a person to even ask the question. Because the whole, everything about you as a jiva is only really meant to respond to the world. Your sense organs, and your mind, all of your experiences, your hands, your legs, your speech, everything about you is meant to interact and be part and parcel of this creation. And so here you are witnessing the creation. Maybe you have Shraddha, you're within the Vedic community or in a religious community, you have a relationship with God, you know. But even with that, you can be a bhakta, you can be a devotee to the Lord for how many billions of lifetimes, and always just wanting to go to heaven. Let me go to heaven, and then you take another birth, and let me go to heaven, let me, you know, worship the Lord. All of these type of things. It's all within duality. Or you might, at point, what good is it to worship the Bhagwan? I don't even believe in that. Then you go through another billion years.
Now the question, I think an interesting question is, how much do you really need Shraddha? You know, because if you have knowledge, I'm just wondering about that, you know?
You don't need Shraddha. Shraddha resolves into knowledge. Uh-huh. Shraddha is all pre-knowledge.
Right.
It's like sometimes Swamiji translates that as faith pending understanding. It's not blind faith that goes on forever. Mm-hmm. It's just, we use the example as like, say you're exposed to the Upanishads or to a teacher who's teaching the Upanishads, mm-hmm. and there's something you don't know. There's something that rings true to the degree that you're open to studying it.
Mm-hmm.
That's Shraddha. Because you don't really know. You have faith pending understanding. It rings true. There's some samskara there. It rings true, and you want to know. And that's a big thing, because you're committing, you know, your time and your attention, you know, to the study of something. That requires faith pending understanding, but it doesn't leave. Shraddha resolves into knowledge.
Yeah, that's clear. One other thing I was wondering, you know, it seems like that, I think you even said it, I'd like to go back to listening to it again, but I think I heard you say it tonight also, it's not really an accumulation of something. So, I mean, we're not accumulating knowledge, and then when we've accumulated enough knowledge, then we suddenly see what is. It seems rather like that all the knowledge just takes away the illusion, and then what we're left with is some clarity of understanding.
Oh, I see what you mean. Yeah, it's a total chipping away of ignorance.
Yeah, it's more like that, right?
Yeah, it is that. It's called Ajnana Nivritti.
Mm-hmm.
We think of knowledge as positive, like now I'm accumulating the thought modification of that painting, and now I'm accumulating this and this,
yeah,
and adding until I have all this knowledge. But here it's really removing ignorance, because the self experience is already completely present. My being is already completely present. It's not an experience to be gained.
Mm-hmm.
It's that the ignorance has to be removed. Ajnana Nivritti means the the negation of the elimination of ignorance. That's exactly what it means, the words.
So what if you're just kind of, this is, I'm going back to my question, what if you're only moderately skilled at removing this ignorance?
Well, it's not really your job. It's the teacher's job. Your job is to be present. Your mind has to be present. So if your mind can't be present, then we have things like, that's antakarna shuddhi and different meditation techniques and upasana and things to try to steady the mind. Because say you're sitting in, you're in class, but your body is there, but your mind is all over the place. It can't focus. So you come back and hear a few more words and you're off again.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess it's always like comparing myself to, like Swamiji had this elegant, one of the most superior minds you could think of,
and used it
yeah. elegantly, mm-hmm. you know. And so he was successful with his study. And do you need to be that elevated to have that kind of mind to be equal in his freedom?
No, but Swamiji is kind of a problem in that way because, you know, his upadhi, his mission in life, his footprint is so huge. He's a special person, you know. There's special people like Carl Jung and Einstein and Ramana. There's special people who have a very huge footprint, and they make a huge difference in the lives of many, many people, and they make a contribution to society that is magnanimous, you know. And then his students don't have that big of a footprint, you know. And so in terms of your accomplishment in the world, won't in any way compare. You know, that's how people start thinking.
Yeah.
But then if you start thinking, well, for me to be a Mahatma, mm-hmm. to be a Jnani, to have self-knowledge, I also have to have this huge footprint.
Or not just a footprint in the world, but a footprint in your own mind,
or
your own mental capacity.
Yeah, well, what if you say, I also have to be a Sanskrit scholar who can chant the Gita from beginning to end and backwards, like he used to do all the time. Chant it forwards, chant it backwards. He used to do it once a day, forwards and backwards.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
So I, you know, to be a great jnani, I have to be fluent in Sanskrit and have this incredible memory and this and that and all of these type of qualifications
yeah,
that actually don't have anything to do with your knowledge. You don't need to have Sanskrit for your knowledge. You don't need to have a great memory. Those are fun. I wish my memory was much better than it is. It would be great.
You just need vasana. That's
you're talking about the cumulative knowledge.
Yeah.
Right there. I mean,
yeah, exactly. Exactly. You don't need that. You know, but you need to have a mind that can follow this teaching. And then you have to have, you know, the patience to work on the parts of your mind that cause you pain. That is actually a different issue, but it's an issue that we're all concerned about. You know, because you don't want, just like you don't want your body to cause you pain. We're concerned about that too. Like if your body is causing you pain, then you care for it and do whatever you can. You think that's perfectly natural. And even say you have knowledge, you have nishta in this knowledge, and your body is causing you pain, and there's something you can do about it. Will you do it or not? I would say, of course, you're not going to think, oh, I have knowledge, and so I'm not going to take care of my body. Why would you do that? It doesn't make any sense. If you have a pain, then you'll just naturally take care of it. We don't have the same attitude toward our mind or our emotions and, you know, the different ways that we were hurt, you know. But once you understand and start gaining those kind of skills to help, skills that are in harmony and support your harmony with and support your knowledge, then those become tools and skills that you use to take care of your hurts and your mind, and you look at your the attitudes with which you approach life, if they're causing pain, then those all of those things become sadhana.
And any mind can do that if it has that interest or that need.
Any mind can do it. Any mind can do it.
Mm-hmm.
But I would say that part of doing it also has to do with learning, because yourself is not ever and never will be sullied or injured or hurt or wounded. Atma is not wounded, is not hurt. It is perfect. It's never changed. It can't be touched or hurt in any way. So the self, the clay of the pot that fills all of your experience, is fine. Because of our childhood and our upbringing, we have structures in our mind, and our personality has shaped in such a way, you know, that we have to learn how to handle ourselves, just like we have to learn how to handle and hold other people. And some areas, you know, that our mind is more problematic. It needs more care. It needs to be cared for and understood. That's how it is, you know.
Is there a Sanskrit word for that self? The self we have to learn to handle, as opposed to the
no,
Atma?
No, then we can use the Atma for that, but then the Atma is being used as the mind.
Oh,
so
okay.
It's the manas.
Okay.
The manas.
Okay.
Just in this verse, we often in the Bhagavad Gita, Atma is used for the mind, or it's used for the buddhi, or it's used for the Atma, or the Paramatma, Brahman also. So it has to. It's a word that's used in context, right? Just like we do in ourselves. If I say I'm thinking, I mean my mind is thinking, right? If I say I am thinking, that I is the mind I'm referring to, not the Atma. I would never say the Atma is thinking. Right?
Okay. So all of this is going on in the mind.
Is what?
All of this, all this maturing, all this, like, who does it...
It's all going on in the mind.
It's all going on in the mind.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a part of our mind that says, I don't like this. I want to change that.
Yeah, and what you don't like it is because it's causing pain. Otherwise, there's no reason not to like it. You know, either it's neutral and it's fine. It's not. You don't even notice it because it's neutral. Or it's full and complete. Or it's, you know, something that you don't want. You don't want because it's not comfortable. You know, and so then that thing becomes something to pay some attention to. You know, and some of the things that are not comfortable, let me put it, how to say that? They're illegitimately not comfortable. Like, for instance, I'm not comfortable with my body. I don't like the way my body looks. Well, your poor body. You know, I mean, what's it going to do?
Change.
You know? So you're having a relationship with something about yourself that then we have to go and look at that relationship. It's not about changing your body. It's changing the relationship with your body. I don't like the way I look, or I don't like this, or I don't like that. Or I don't like my mind, it's not smart enough. Or if only I had a better memory, I'd be happy. Or if I was more intelligent, I'd be happy. Or if I was more this or more that. All of this is, you know, this lack of self-acceptance. So that all requires work, because that causes a lot of pain, because you're with your body all the time. You're with your mind all the time. What if you don't like it? Oh, you know, it's like turning against yourself. You know, there's diseases like that. You know, your body starts eating itself.
Mm-hmm.
And here your mind is like that. It's attacking yourself instead of being your best friend.
Mm.
In fact, there's verses in the Gita like that. You have to be your best friend, not your worst enemy.
Mm-hmm. Mental autoimmune.
What?
Mental autoimmune.
Yeah, autoimmune deficiency with it. Yeah, exactly.
Where your
system turns on you instead of helping you.
You were speaking of Ananda and recognizing your own nature. Is that more like an individualized own nature, or is that more like the Atman?
No, I'm talking about the
what you think is individualized self right. is Brahman.
Right.
Yeah, and that's what I'm talking about. You done?
Very good. It was good.